Welcome to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. And this is Benjamin.
Godzilla. Godzilla.
Benjamin is 4 years old. He loves dinosaurs, and he's walked over to tell KCRW's Robin Estrin all about it. They're standing in the driveway at a family child care in Boyle Heights. Playtime is ending, and Benjamin is starting to get reflective.
Benjamin, what did you do today?
I was being bad.
Adriana Lorenzo, who runs this child care and is setting up for nap time right now, disagrees.
I don't think he was being that bad today. But every time they ask him, yeah, I was being a bad boy. Yeah, that's Benji. But today he wasn't. He was just normal.
The story you're about to hear is about this place. Lorenzo Family Child Care. Now, Benjamin's family relies on it. Many families do, but they may be in trouble. Money the state of California promised to help this child care service survive the pandemic is months delayed. It's a problem for providers all across the state. Lorenzo doesn't know how much longer she can stay open. And now Robin picks up the story from here.
Decades ago, before Lorenzo opened this child care in Boyle Heights, she grew up in one, run by her mom in their family home.
I remember being little and telling my mom, oh, I'm never going to work in a daycare. I hate having kids every day, all day in my house. They're always in my room grabbing my things. I started working with my mom at 16.
At 19, she opened up her own child care business.
I already had my daughter, so it was either I work in a daycare and stay with my daughter or I leave my daughter with my mom. And my mom explained to me, it's the best thing if you're able to raise your kids.
Her oldest is 22 now and has three siblings. Their home is buzzing with activity from Lorenzo's other kids, the ones enrolled in her child care.
I feel like these kids are also my kids. They're with me, with us, more time than what they spend with their own parents.
By us, Lorenzo means her and her husband, Jose Martinez.
How did you guys meet?
Funny story. Daycare.
So I was a single father. You know, I was a single father, and I was looking for a daycare because I had to work. And then that's when I met her.
Lorenzo and Martinez love the work they do. Their home is strewn with toys and books. The walls are covered in the letters of the alphabet and finger-painted art. But the days are long, sometimes 12 hours, and the margins are slim.
We're like every month pushing it to like stretch that money to hit so we could wait for the next paycheck.
The families they serve are low income and don't pay fees. Instead, the cost of their care is subsidized by government agencies. Lorenzo and other family child care providers like her don't get paid very much at all. At the end of the month, after bills, Lorenzo says,
we're left with like $1,800 for what my kids need, for our food, for our gas. So that's where we're struggling right now.
When it's especially tight, Martinez drives Amazon delivery. Lorenzo helps sometimes, along with their two youngest kids, who do their homework in the truck and sometimes help sort packages. The family is also in debt.
We had to get loans. A lot of my fellow providers had to go through loans, had to ask other people to borrow money to stay open.
At the start of the pandemic, Lorenzo took out a loan for about $5,000. She needed to hire more help with cleaning and buy a lot of disinfectant. She had to buy room dividers to help the kids with distancing and improve her Wi-Fi setup. Her daycare kids and her own kids were logging into school from the house. They needed headsets, laptops.
And also all the toys that we have, we buy them out of pocket. Everything that you see here is out of our pocket.
Over time, that loan haunted Lorenzo. Last year, the interest was so high, she and Martinez decided to take out a second loan just to pay the first one off.
It's a 29.9 interest rate, but it was either that or we were going to close.
They thought they'd be able to pay the second loan off quickly. That's because last year, the state of California promised family child cares hundreds of millions of dollars in federal pandemic relief. For most, that relief hasn't come.
It was supposed to be last winter. We're almost in summer, and that stipend's still not here.
The California Department of Social Services, the state agency that's supposed to send out the money, still hasn't delivered most of the promised stipends. 8 months after state lawmakers authorized the payments, department officials declined to be interviewed for this story. In a written statement to KCRW, a spokesperson blamed the holdup on, quote, contracting delays, without elaborating. The spokesperson said money has started to trickle out, but it could be months before Lorenzo or most other family childcare providers in the state actually get paid. After learning the money had started to go out, I went back to Lorenzo's childcare in Boyle Heights to find out if she was relieved. Not really.
If it's this summer, we could still hold on. It'll be really hard, but we still could hold on just if they don't keep just saying that, oh yeah, summer, and then summer turns to fall, and then fall turns again to winter. That's the problem.
Lorenzo was right to be concerned. Just a few days ago, the state said it may take until the end of September. She doesn't know how much longer she can hang on, but she does know that if she has to close her doors, it will leave families scrambling.
Hi. We'll be right there.
Elijah, can you say hi?
Say hi.
Hi.
Elijah is 1 year old, and his grandma, Sandra Rascone, takes him to Lorenzo's childcare every morning before she goes to work as support staff for LAUSD.
I know that my kids are safe. I know that they're well taken care of. And literally, my kids cry when I pick them up. So I kind of get like, but I like hurt because they're like crying. I'm like, well, don't you want to go home?
So if Lorenzo family childcare were to close,
it would be really, really bad because I don't have family members that can watch them. I don't have anybody that I can trust that could watch him. So that means I would not be able to go to work. Then I'm not going to pay my car payment, and we might not have a car, and we might not have a house, and we might not have food.
Adriana doesn't want to close. In fact, it's the opposite. She wants to expand her childcare operation from her home to a full-fledged childcare center. She's been applying for grants. And both she and Martinez have gone back to school to get advanced degrees in early childhood education. But now they're talking about holding off on enrolling in their next round of classes. For KCRW, I'm Robin Estrin.
The world is remembering a true icon, the queen of rock and roll, Tina Turner, who passed on today at the age of 83. So we here at Greater LA want to remember her too, even for just one mere moment.
You must understand, the touch of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl. Possess a track, it's physical, only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more than.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. If summer reading is on the agenda, or any reading for that matter, at any time of the year, you are bound to love a regular monthly series that we're kicking off today. It is called Bookmarked. And once every few weeks, KCRW's Juliana Mayo will read and chat with an L.A. author, writing about the City of Angels to give you some ideas about what should be in your civic library. So, Juliana, take it away.
You, Mr. Bemis, are a reader, and a reader of books. Collected works of Dickens, collected works of George Bernard Shaw.
I love the Joy Luck Club.
Oh, what do you think, Tom Clancy?
That's not fair at all.
I'm sitting here in a beautiful Montecito guest house, sipping tea with the author of Drop City, The Women, and most recently Blue Skies, T.C. Boyle. T.C., thank you so much for being a guinea pig.
And my pleasure, Juliana. Thanks for the invite.
For my first Bookmarked. It is much appreciated.
Wow. Well, I'm honored. The first one?
Yeah, you're the first one. You're setting the tone.
Well,
no,
good,
no pressure.
Good. This is the inaugural one.
It's the inaugural one.
All right. What fun.
So let's talk about Blue Skies. I found a level of optimism in this book that I don't know that I always find in a T.C. Boyle book. And I feel like sometimes as people get older, they become more pessimistic. You know, I'm thinking of like Tortilla Curtain or San Miguel. Mm. And it feels hopeful in a way, even as the world is crashing down around everybody. Can you talk about that?
That is so kind of you to say that, because the reviews have been quite strong, but they're also saying it's a dark, dark book. And I don't really get it. I'm just trying to assess what the world is like. You know, we're all living with global warming. I wrote about it in A Friend of the Earth back in the year 2000, projecting to 2026. But we're already there. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to project maybe 10 years in the future and see what it was like. I did end the book on a slightly hopeful note because I was writing this during the pandemic and writing it at a time when the monarch butterflies population had crashed. And incidentally, right out here, that you're looking out there,
yeah,
that is where the monarchs, one of their famous roosts, right in this back portion here, where they would come in winter to overwinter.
Oh, wow.
When I moved into this house 30 years ago after having left L.A., there were thousands of them. It was like confetti. From November, December, the last couple of years, hardly any. But now the numbers are improving.
Yeah, last year they rebounded, right? Yeah, there was a little glimmer of hope last year.
Right.
I thought about that when I was reading this.
Okay,
I was
so
like, oh.
You get to the end of this book and there is a glimmer of hope. But yeah, I mean, it's I don't want to depress anybody. I don't want to turn anybody off from the hope of a green future. You know, we've come a long ways in terms of trying to assess how we can have a lesser footprint on the planet. But still, you talk about pessimism, 8 billion people. What are we going to do? Now, in this book, there are certain futurist solutions like cellular meat, for instance.
Sure, which is actually
real
not
meat.
That futuristic. I mean, the future is kind of now.
Right, it's now, it's now. Yes,
it.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
What a brilliant idea. You do away with the torture of the cattle, the slaughterhouses, the cutting down of the forests and the Amazon so that people can graze cows. Of course, the question is, what are they going to do for a living?
Mm-hmm.
But still, there are some solutions that give me some hope. Yeah.
I recently saw a headline for a review of Blue Skies that said, it's the end of the world, and T.C. Boyle's characters feel meh. And that was 100% not my take at all after reading this book. And I wonder how you feel about that. Because when I read it, I thought maybe one of the characters felt meh. But we follow three characters who have three really different takes.
I can't really respond to that.
Okay.
I don't know really what that means. But
sure.
I guess my object in beginning this, the book just evolves as it's going to evolve, is what is it like for regular people to have to live with constant catastrophe. Again, when I wrote Friend of the Earth in the year 2000, I thought all this was going to happen in 2050. I'd be dead. I don't have to really worry about it. It already
future.
Was here by 2015, and now we are really reaping the horrors worldwide of these catastrophic weather events. Right here in Montecito,
sure, I was about to say,
we had...
Did you experience anything in the mudslides?
Montecito, 5 years ago, 23 of my neighbors were killed, and that is two blocks from here. Where we're sitting right now, as you can see, is on the top of a little hill. So the water courses, And it's an old house from 1909. They knew where to build. The water course is down below, and it's right here on two blocks away. 23 people killed, all these houses swept to the ocean. You know, people talk of a mudslide. It's a debris flow. There were boulders the size of Volkswagens, and hundreds of them. And meanwhile, thousands upon thousands of boulders coming down and just grinding everything and tearing down the telephone poles. Whole houses, there's nothing left, not a brick, not a pipe, nothing. Just swept down and out to sea. It's pretty frightening. But in any case, we're all living with it now. And I don't know if the characters feel meh. The idea here, and part of the comedy, I think, is it's a new normal. We just have to accept this. And what does that mean? Where do we go from here?
How many new normals can we have?
Yeah, right. Until we're just living on a burned out cinder. And of course, since Friend of the Earth, when people want to know what the good news is, and I've always, you know, been so optimistic, and I would tell them, well, the good news is that in 3.5 to 4 billion years, the earth will, the sun will swell up and burn the earth till it's like a charcoal briquette. That's the good news.
Especially if you're not here for it. Speaking of the pandemic, I was thinking about that as all of the characters just consumed so much booze. And I thought about during the pandemic how everybody was kind of anesthetizing themselves with booze and alcoholism rose. And I wonder if that played a part in your thinking or if the booze is something else.
It happens that the heroine of the book and her husband are alcoholics. Young alcoholics, partying alcoholics. I don't know if we want to read too deeply into it. This is just a feature of who these people are. And yes, of course, when we're isolated and during the pandemic, alcoholism shot up. What are you going to do? There's no place to go. There's nothing to do. So, hey, let's open a bottle of rum, you know? I've written about addiction a lot. I mean, I come from a long line of alcoholics and drug abusers. I know all about it. It just happens that these young characters, like when I was young, have that sense of it's a party. We're partying. And, you know, Todd, the husband of Kat, the heroine, his job is to be an ambassador for Bacardi. That is, he goes around and gives parties and entertains people to sell the brand. And it seemed like that and bartender, by the way, are very dangerous jobs along those lines.
Indeed. I appreciated the correct pronunciation of Bacardi.
Well, he,
and all that came with it.
Yes. Well, he doesn't even speak Spanish, but he has to roll his R's and so on when he says Bacardi.
The story takes place in California, but it also takes place in Florida. And I'm wondering where Florida came from for you. What inspired that setting?
Again, during the catastrophic few years we've had in terms of meteorological conditions around the world, here on the West Coast, we're suffering a 1,200-year drought. And don't be fooled by the rains of the winter, the miraculous rains. We're still, dealing with this. Meanwhile, one of my closest friends lives in the vicinity of northern Florida on the coast that I've chosen to write about. And their problem is a little different. The glaciers are melting. The sea is rising. The king tides are coming more often. Everything is flooding. And it seems such an ironic contrast to me. You know, we are drying up. There's no water. There's no hope. It's never going to rain again. And meanwhile, they are inundated. So it seemed to me natural to have a bi-coastal family. And in my telling, Kat, she's 26, she's out of college, she's living with her boyfriend who is going to marry her, they're going to get married. His mother dies, and she left him a very nice beach house on the ocean in Florida. Something they could never have afforded, you know, how can you buy a beach house? And so it seemed like a really good idea to go there and live in it. It's free, it's all paid for. All you have to do is pay your utilities and you're living in a beach house.
Until they arrive and the ocean is lapping at the piling.
Yeah, nothing is ideal, I guess, yeah.
There's a moment where Kat's talking to her mom and her mother says something like, I don't understand how you can live there. And she says, well, it's just like LA, except we're not on fire all the time, you know? And I can't tell you how many times I've had that comment come from my mother who lives in Florida, where her town was just decimated by a hurricane last year.
Yeah, okay, so that's a kind of contrast that interested me. Mm-hmm. I love rain. I came from New York, and I don't ever see enough rain out here, you know. I love rain. I love gloomy days. I love all of that. But I've never quite seen enough rain to until this winter. This winter was great. I loved it. I just loved it. And now we're having the super bloom everywhere. It's just pretty wonderful. But it's just a blip, I think, you know.
I wondered about, is it Odile? Odile, she seems to face the fewest consequences. She is doing her best. She's a very well-meaning person who's trying to get by. She's the kind of person who has rain barrels, who, you know, who composts and does all of the right things. But you see that maybe she's just making a tiny dent.
Yes.
But is
okay, so let's just set it up for the listeners who may not know.
Please.
So it's a family. Ottilie is the mother. She's in late 60s, early 70s. And she wants to do right and do good by the environment and lower her carbon footprint. And one of her aims in this book, kind of comically, is to include more insects in her diet. And when we first meet her, she's giving a dinner party with cuisine of insects. She represents for me people like myself who want to help, and we can all help, and we all do, but we're overwhelmed. We're just overwhelmed. Meanwhile, her daughter Kat is the heroine we've already talked about. She's now living in Florida. And her son Cooper is the kind of environmentalist who preaches at us all the time. And I don't mind that. Right. But if you preach at somebody, then they will do the opposite. For instance, my book, When the Killing's Done, which deals with the removal of invasive species on Santa Cruz Island, right across the channel here. We could see it from here.
I have to say, I did not realize how much of that was true.
Oh, it is true.
So
it's true.
After
amazing
reading
story.
It,
yes.
When I looked it up, I thought only T.C. Boyle could come up with this wackiness, the birth control dropped from the sky and all that, and no.
Yeah, it was what attracted me to the story, and we don't have time to get into it here, is the absurdity of invasive species and trying to remove them. And the concatenation of events that leads you to despair or perhaps happiness, by the way, in the actual fact of Santa Cruz Island, because there are a limited suite of species, animal species anyway, it's much more in balance now. My wife and I were privileged to be there, this is 10, 15 years ago, when the first two bald eagles were let go on the island, since they were driven off the island by the golden eagles years ago, because their eggs were fragile from eating fish. They're piscivorous, and so the DDT. It was pretty thrilling. And by the way, they're chicks. They're this big, and their claws are the size of your hands. Uh-oh. But it was thrilling. Uh-huh. The first two, they open the cage, the biologists, and there it goes. It's really quite fascinating. So animals, animal life, our being as animals on this planet is what I write about and what fascinates me.
Sure. And it also seems like this man against nature comes up a lot, and maybe the futility of man against nature. Like, you're always going to lose.
Right. And woman against nature.
Sure, sure.
The gophers in our garden. Yeah. Yes. So anyway, the biologist came to me after I had written this book. I'd give readings and so on in the audience afterwards. A bunch of biologists would be there. And they said, in essence, you know, we love what you're doing because we have been talking about this for years and nobody pays any attention. But when you make it into a compelling story in which there are characters and you see the world through their eyes and root for them or hate them or whatever it's going to be, it brings a power of emotion to this, to these issues. And again, I shouldn't say that. I don't write fiction in order to convert anybody to anything. I'm not advocating anything, except between you and me now, and on the radio, of course, or write an essay. But in fiction, that's not what fiction does. Fiction is a kind of seduction. And if people become more environmentally conscious through reading books like Blue Skies or When the Killing's Done or A Friend of the Earth, great. Hallelujah, that's how I feel. But fiction is a seduction. It's not a place to broadcast propaganda of any way, no matter how great it may be. It's an experience meant for each reader individually to decide for him or herself how they're going to feel about the issues of the book. My object is to dramatize them.
Yeah, and when you're living in Montecito, you're kind of living in the middle of the drama, at least of late.
Yes, well, the Montecito mudslide or debris flow was quite a shocking event. Again, right close to the house here, we were just lucky to have escaped it.
Yeah, I guess I find that interesting that you see a way through, that you see a way to live with it. You found a way to live with it.
Well, it's either that or suicide. And of course, as I have told people with a friend of the earth, and they're wondering, well, what can we do if we're really committed environmentalists? Well, I have a compost pile out there. Go right out of the compost pile, shoot yourself in the back of the head. That's what you can do if you're really committed. And it's a pretty bleak forecast for the world. You see, the Syrian refugees were climate refugees, really, because, you know, the gangs took over. The farmers couldn't make a living, and there was the drought and so on. But, you know, what about Bangladesh? Hundreds of millions of people will be displaced by rising sea waters. Where are they going to go? Where are they going to eat? Where are they going to stand? How are they going to live? It is overwhelming and depressing. And so you get a character like Audley, or me, or you, who tries to lower our carbon footprint even a bit helps. Again, we were talking about the monarchs that come here. Right next door here in the other property that I have here, we planted all native plants, and particularly milkweed. And we see a couple of generations of monarchs flying around here every year. It's that simple. Right. If you plant the milkweed, the monarchs will come, and they need it.
Sure.
Monarchs can only feed on many plants, but they can only lay their eggs and have their larvae, caterpillars, hatch on milkweed, which enables them to build up these alkaloids inside their bodies that make them poisonous to predators. That's their defense, evolutionary defense. So if there's milkweed, and of course there used to be a lot of it, there used to be fields, it will help with their recovery.
I grew up in northern Florida, and that was one of the routes that the monarchs would come from. And I remember just swarms of them on milkweed. And now they barely come through anymore. Far fewer than in California.
And it's to be so sad to have them go. By the road over here is Butterfly Road, Butterfly Lane, Butterfly Beach, Butterfly everything. But, you know, are they going to be like dinosaurs? Is it a vestige or something? And they're so remarkable. They're not only beautiful, but they migrate. Insects don't migrate so much, but these do.
And over a life cycle, right? So, like, how do they even know where they're going?
Right.
They live and die in, like, three generations before they get... Yeah, it's kind of magical.
Yeah, it's in their genes.
So which came first, Cooper or the interest in butterflies? Like, was that a defining characteristic for him already because you loved butterflies and flying creatures? Or
yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. And another irony here is that he's dating an acarologist, and this is a person who studies ticks. And I have had many experiences with ticks. There is a weird voodoo sometimes to writing books, and the world comes and conforms to what you're imagining, so that there's a chapter in which Cooper and his girlfriend, the acarologist, go out in the field. He's going to help her collect ticks. They drag a white sheet through the bushes, and they see what falls on it. But it was a windy day, and it was just flapping, and they gave up. And then they went to a club and danced for a while, and they go home, and they're getting romantic. And he goes in and takes off his shirt, and he realizes that on his arm is a tick larva, a tiny little larva on his arm here. And that's the end of the chapter. Then I moved on to an Audley cat chapter and an Audley chapter. Meanwhile, in the interval, I went out into the mountains here, and I came back, and my forearm hurt like holy hell, as if I'd slammed it against something.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was a tick larva. Now, if you get Lyme disease, which I've had several times, you don't feel anything. This was different. This was giving me cellulitis, which, thank God, my doctor discovered. Telemedicine during the COVID-19 lockdown. I held my arm up, and he said, okay, and gave me some powerful antibiotics, clindamycin, to control it, and it was touch and go for a while. It was controlled. He said to me this, I held up my arm like this. He said, okay, take a magic marker and write around the margin to see if it spreads. Well, it did. It suddenly spread past the margin. It spread to the other side of my arm. I was getting concerned. A week is good going by. But fortunately, in my case, this finally cleared up. For Cooper, however, I immediately inflicted it on him in the next chapter. And he had a more severe reaction than I.
A different outcome, yes.
A different outcome, yes.
Your love for language comes through so clearly. And there's, when I was reading it, anytime I read a T.C. Boyle book, there's words that come up, and it could be simply stated, very Hemingway, whatever. And you find the most beautiful word to convey instead of being a simple stater sometimes. And I just find that so lovely. Like, did you always have this love for words, this reverence for words that is so clear in your work?
Yes, of course. I love the rhythm and beat of the language. I never write anything without music playing. Mm-hmm. It's very important for me to have it scan and beat properly, and to be beautiful. Beautiful language. This is the art of it, which is why I've never really liked genre writing. It might be a great story that's being told, but the writing is flat and arrhythmic, and it's not exciting or beautiful. And doesn't interest me. So yeah, the beginning of all this is beautiful language. Everything else has to derive from that.
So, and what are you listening to while you're writing Blue Skies?
Well, I am a rocker. I'm a rocker and a blues guy, mm-hmm. but that's when I'm doing emails or something. Mm-hmm. When I'm doing my writing, I must focus, and I can't do that with rock and roll. So it's classical or jazz.
Okay. So no words.
No words. Okay. Right. Sometimes opera, but in a language I don't understand. Then it's okay.
Fair enough.
And you know how it is. Everybody's had the experience. You're writing something or you're reading deeply. Music is playing and you hear the music, but then for a while you don't hear it at all. But it's there. I need it. I've never written anything without music playing. Nor have I ever written anything out by hand. I've got to be at my desk. I've got to be typing. And there's something of the rhythm of typing that goes with the rhythm of the music and so on.
Well, I wondered about that. I read long ago that you used a typewriter. Do you still use a typewriter or have you moved on to computers?
No, as soon as computers were invented, I've used a computer because you can make it perfect. Yeah. So speaking of which, I was thinking about Ray Carver the other day. And Ray, when he became well-known and had a little bit of money, he lived in a house that had an ocean view. But he refused to work with an ocean view. He worked against a blank wall. No pictures, no nothing, just a blank wall. Because that's what he needed to focus. I need music, and I have windows around. I can look out, and there's the squirrel, or there's the hawk going by. That's okay, as long as it's not a distraction.
So what should we go out on then? What song should we end this interview with?
Song?
Yeah.
What song?
What song? What piece should we go out on?
I used as an epigraph, one of the epigraphs for A Friend of the Earth, Tom Waits, "The Earth Died Screaming." That's the way to go out.
Okay, let's do it. T.C. Boyle, thank you so much for your time today. It's been
You're
a
most
real
welcome.
Treat.
Thank you. And the earth died screaming.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The Hollywood writer's strike keeps going, almost 4 weeks now, and as studios continue to dodge the demands of the Writers Guild, there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. Now, sustaining a strike of this length can be a big challenge, especially for the many folks on the picket lines who aren't getting paid. So one organization is doing its best to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, how do you help? All I need is my brother. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Santa Monica-based nonprofit Humanitas has been providing grocery cards and family care packages to folks on the picket lines through their Groceries for Writers program. Their executive director, Michelle Franke, joins me now to talk about it. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
What inspired this program? How were you able to launch it so quickly after the strike began?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So for some context, Humanitas was founded in 1974. We are a nonprofit that honors and empowers film and television writers whose work explores the human condition in a meaningful way. So we have a number of programs and events that we've presented for the last four decades. And the week of the strike, we put out a statement in support of our community, and we met with the WGA to confirm that our programs were operating in accordance with strike rules. And then I headed out to the picket lines to deliver donuts and supplies. This was first to Fox and to the Amazon picket lines. And soon after, we received a really generous donation to keep snacks and supplies moving. And so the next day, which was May 4th, I was able to take a number of packages out. They had food, candy, fruit, coffee, water, wipes, sunscreen, ibuprofen to folks who were on the line. But our staff knew that it was going to be really important to pivot towards something more substantial to support both individuals and families with this donation that we received. So we made the decision to distribute grocery gift cards to early career WGA member writers, as they stand for fair pay and protections in the workplace.
I want to be clear, Michelle, because, you know, a lot of folks would be like, well, this is a strike of their own accord, right? But a lot of these writers have been living, you know, with very low pay, some of whom are on food stamps, right? So you guys have been helping not even since the strike, but even before.
Absolutely. So we have folks who are in early career positions right now who are, as you said, facing food insecurity. We have people on food stamps. We, by collecting stories through our application, have heard more from folks who are struggling to feed their families. Many households where both partners are out of work as well. So we're doing what we can to make sure that money that's come in through donors is reaching them by way of these grocery cards so that they are able to sustain their efforts on the line. These days are long, they're exhausting, and we want to make sure that they have food in them, that they feel well nourished so that they're able to stay really focused on this fight.
And there are others who are affected by this strike, not just the people who authorized or who are on the picket lines, but also below the line workers, right? And support staff who might also be out of work because of the strike.
Absolutely. So Humanitas is focused our efforts because we are an organization that is geared toward, you know, film and television writers, but we're collecting additional resources when below the line folks reach out to us where we can, you know, recommend that they're able to seek support as well.
How are you finding, Michelle, the people who need this support? I mean, how are they finding you? I mean, is there some kind of application process that you can find online? How do you go about it?
It's been over social media so far. We asked folks in our community to help us spread the word, and we've seen, you know, tremendous efforts to make sure that early career folks know where to find us. But I'm doing interviews like this so that additional people can find out. It's really important for us to get the word out that we're still taking grocery requests. We're also still, you know, keeping our donate page open. People can go onto the Humanitas donate page and use the drop-down Groceries for Writers to support Groceries for Writers. At this point, we've had over 400 people request grocery support from us. Over half of those folks are television staff writers. We're also seeing a number of feature writers. And as of this week, we've delivered over 400 cards. And the cards are $100 each. The whole system is set up to be a really easy application. So if folks are early career WGA member writers, I encourage you to go to humanitasprize.org, explore the application. You need two forms of ID to apply, but we're trying to make it really easy on folks to get these grocery cards because we realize that people in tough situations don't have tremendous emotional capacity to do extended applications. So we're trying to make it as simple as possible.
There's the key term right there, emotional capacity, right? A lot of people stretched really thin. Michelle Franke, the executive director of Humanitas, which runs the Groceries for Writers program. Michelle, thanks for coming on. We appreciate all you're doing.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, our producers go on a hike and find some outside treasures in the form of food. Tell us what's on your mind. Share a story idea. Get the podcast all at kcrw.com/GLA. Get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, by the way. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all help put the show together this evening. Oh, Tina, thank you for the memories. Thank you for the songs and your life. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thank you for your time and your ear. Have a great night. You're simply the best.